A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The following episode contains disturbing and graphic accounts of survivor experiences. It may not be suitable for younger audiences. Please listen with care.
Now, in High Impact, they held us in dog cages. And we were forced to lay there or sit there in these stress positions all day long, 8 hours a day in the hot desert sun. Most of us, especially if we were then restrained and made to lay down on the hot sand, would lose like 60% of our skin because it would be burned off, and we would have boils everywhere, burns and injuries on our chin, just rubbed raw from the sand. I mean, the pain was just indescribable.
Hey everyone, it's Paris Hilton. I'm back. If you listened to season 1 of Trapped in Treatment, you heard my personal story of my time in the troubled teen industry. After running away from 3 programs, when I was 17, I was transported to the Provo Canyon School in Utah, which would be my last stop. I would be at Provo Canyon School for 11 months, completely cut off from the outside world. My experience gives me personal insight into the dark, tangled web of the troubled teen industry, or TTI for short. The troubled teen industry is a casual term to describe residential programs that claim to help struggling teens. But as we know, these programs often cause way more harm than good. When I started this journey of Trapped in Treatment, I needed to make sure other survivors out there knew that they weren't alone. We share a common background, a common experience, but so many other people in our day-to-day lives just don't quite understand. Over the past few years, I've been lucky enough to connect with so many of you who went through hell and back at Provo Canyon and similar programs. You are the ones keeping me in this fight. That's exactly why we're back, to continue building awareness and uncover the story behind WASP. This season, we're following the journey of one man who went from working as a dorm parent at Provo Canyon School to running his own empire of troubled teen programs called the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools, or WASP for short. His name is Robert Litchfield. These accounts are incredibly shocking and disturbing. My fellow survivors and I are determined to bring awareness and fight against an industry that has caused trauma to countless individuals. And by listening to these stories, we can only hope that you'll feel angry enough to join the fight too. Despite the allegations of abuse, fraud, and everything else that you'll hear over the course of this shocking season, very few leaders at these institutions have faced any sort of legal consequences. Litchfield himself has never been charged with any crime or held accountable for any of the allegations you'll hear about this season. Instead, there are plans to name buildings after him in Utah. Is there any justice in that? We will not give up. we will not stop standing up for ourselves, our fellow survivors, and the youth locked in programs today. This is an expose of a notorious network of programs that extended across state lines and country borders and would become the subject of multiple FBI investigations and decade-long court cases. This is the story of the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools. This is the story of WASP.
I'm Caroline Cole. I'm a survivor. I spent 2.5 years of my formative teen years in one of these teen treatment programs, and I'm here to advocate for all of those people who aren't able to. As one of the largest troubled teen industry organizations, WASP left tens of thousands of survivors in its wake, including me. In total, I gave up 2.5 years of my life to WASP. This search for justice is personal.
And I'm Rebecca Mellinger-Grown. As head of impact for Paris Hilton's company, 1111 Media, I've been on the front lines with her to reform the troubled teen industry through state and federal policy change. It is my goal to make sure that people who have never heard about these atrocities come away with an understanding of how this industry impacts every community in America. It's truly a human rights scandal hiding in our backyard.
This season, we're embarking on a journey into one of the most controversial and complex chapters of the troubled teen industry. We're peeling back the layers of an organization that left indelible marks on the lives of many. Over the next 12 weeks, Rebecca and I will investigate the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools, also known as WASP, and Robert Litchfield's massive sphere of influence in the industry.
WASP was a confusing and complex structure by design. Throughout its years, it's believed that the WASP organization would generate millions of dollars through its association with approximately 20 different facilities during its lifetime. We've conducted rigorous research of the various associations and ownership facilities, but we cannot guarantee that every school mentioned was officially or legally tied to WASP or Robert Litchfield.
The stories you will hear are damning, filled with allegations of abuse that go all the way back to the late 80s. During its lifetime, schools within the WASP network would be accused of a myriad of abuses that were detailed in state and federal lawsuits, including things like keeping kids in dog cages, violent physical restraints, forced feeding, rape reenactments with students, and later on, white-collar crimes like racketeering and fraud.
How did one man create one of the largest networks of troubled teen programs in the world, eluding countless lawsuits and allegations of abuse? Why did so many parents buy into these programs and their practices? What is it about our country that allows schools like these to not only open, but to flourish? Brought to you by iHeartRadio, London Audio, and executive producer Paris Hilton. This is season 2 of Trapped in Treatment.
Before we dive into any of these programs specifically, like the one you heard about at the top of this episode, it's imperative to understand where Litchfield came from and how his childhood would impact his future.
Robert Litchfield was born in Utah on a cold afternoon in February 1954. He was the fifth of 13 children and grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We were able to speak with Narvin Litchfield, his younger brother, who shared with us that he and Robert were close growing up. So close that Narvin would eventually follow his brother into the troubled teen industry years later to help grow the WASP empire.
Robert was 7, 8 years older than I am. And we had a unique thing where Dad would take one of the older kids, place him with the younger kids. So I lived in the same room with Robert for 7 years. So we were roommates for 7 years. And so, you know, he had as much to do with the development of who I am as my parents did. He was sort of a second parent in some ways to us.
Narvin and Robert's father, Walter, ran a tight ship at home.
My dad was a drill corps sergeant in the Marine Corps. So it was, if you ever watched The Sound of Music, that's sort of what it was like. You know, we would sound off, march up, and, you know, so there was some level of order that my dad had to establish or it's complete chaos. He established the order of the home, and he did things like, for example, we would get up at 6:30 in the morning. We would literally have a scripture study where we went through the Bible, the Book of Mormon, all of our standard works, where we would read one half an hour before he would go off to work.
Everything in the Litchfield family's lives was about structure and discipline. According to Narvin, his father was a proud Mormon man and instilled a strong reverence for his faith in his children. They started getting involved in the church when they were as young as 6 or 7 years old.
Narvin shares how their home life wasn't always easy. His dad could be erratic and have mood swings or other unpredictable behavior.
My father, for whatever reason, and I had two of my siblings do the same thing. They hit about 27, 28 years old, and they went off mentally. But he had a full nervous breakdown. When he had a full nervous breakdown, he was in American Fork Hospital in American Fork, Utah, mental hospital, which was the, you know, the loony bin for the state of Utah. I don't know how to explain it other than that. But what was amazing is what happened during that time. Because while he was 5 years under doctor's care in a bed, and then would come home sometimes on weekends, and I would only see him then, it happened almost the exact same time I was born. And so I loved my father, but I couldn't understand what was going on, and nobody explained it to me.
Narvin alluded to the fact that his father and many other family members may have struggled with mental illness, but they never really talked about mental health. They had to put it together on their own. Their father's instability was only one aspect that strained the large family.
We also spoke with one of Robert and Narvin's older brothers, Brent Litchfield. During our interview, Brent shared that the oldest Litchfield brother, Lawrence, fondly called Lori, had a difficult birth. A lack of oxygen led to irreversible learning and behavioral disabilities. Brent told us his oldest brother had the mental and emotional capacity of a 2-year-old. He was raised alongside his siblings until one incident changed everything. Here's Brent.
He had hit and hurt several of the kids. And one brother in particular, I don't know why he picked on him. He hit him over the head with a shovel.
According to Brent, Lawrence came close to seriously injuring one of his siblings. Their mother, Wilma, and the family doctor agreed Lori was too great a risk to the other children to stay in the home. Brent shared that Lori was sent away to a state-run institution at 6 years old, where he underwent shock therapy and would spend the rest of his life locked away. What Robert's brothers shared with us was surprising. I had no idea. The man who created the program that I went to had 2 immediate family members also sent to institutions, according to Narvin and Brent. As we know, so much of what happens to us as children impacts the rest of our lives. This includes Litchfield's religious upbringing and the Church of Latter-day Saints.
We spoke with filmmaker and producer Jared Ruga, who released a documentary called No Crime in Sin in 2019. Just like Litchfield, Ruga grew up in Utah, but he himself wasn't Mormon. His mother was, so he grew up in close proximity to the church. That, plus his research for his documentary, gave him insight into what it might have been like coming of age in the Latter-day Saints community. Here's Jared.
You don't want the public embarrassment of someone stepping out of line, because it's a very image-conscious culture. And so when a teen would kind of go wayward, right? Like they would experiment with drugs or alcohol, or God forbid, have premarital sex and get pregnant, or they would come out as queer or questioning. Usually the parents would try and deal with it within the family. They would seek counsel from the bishop at their local ward. And depending on the severity of the issue or the personalities involved, It would either get escalated into higher levels of the church or it would be dealt with more quietly. But almost never did things go to like the civil government, right? Like it was always like, oh, the family can handle this. The church can handle this. We're not going to get, you know, the secular authorities involved.
Established in the mid 19th century, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a Christian church that considers itself the restoration of the original church founded by Jesus Christ. Since then, the religion has grown and built a thriving community in Utah, with a social fabric based on the church and family. Its followers have a reputation for sticking together. Here's Jared again.
The Mormon community, because of its history of kind of being in exile for the first several decades of its existence as a church, is incredibly insular. And so the idea is like, if you're a member of the church, you are of pure heart and mind, and you're a member of the community and you can be trusted. You're one of us.
And Litchfield was one of them. He was surrounded by strong impressions of community, interdependence, and wealth, observing all of the ways that these things could work together.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
While it is no excuse for the stories you will hear, I am fascinated by the personal history of Robert Litchfield. It's because he owned the facility that I went to. I endured years of misery because this man, this one man, decided to open these programs. I wonder if he knew back then, all those years ago, that he would go into the industry just a few years after leaving home. If he knew that following his first volunteer religious mission, he would end up at none other than the infamous Provo Canyon School as an impressionable young man looking for a job.
Litchfield worked his way up at Provo Canyon School, eventually becoming director of residential living. According to a 2003 Los Angeles Times article called Keys to His School's Success, it's God, founder says. A former student described Litchfield as being a, quote, humorless, dictatorial figure who seems to delight in taunting students. In that same Los Angeles Times article, Litchfield expressed that working at Provo Canyon School was, quote, baptism by fire. He told the outlet, "You learn real fast, just as a physician's assistant learns doctoring skills by working with doctors." Defending the program, he went on to say in that article, "God can't help everybody. I don't know how we're going to, but it does provide an opportunity for thousands of kids to improve their lives. Those who choose not to, choose not to." Whether his desire to work in the troubled teen industry was inspired by the experiences in his childhood, a personal desire to help troubled youth, or knowing that this industry was lucrative, he would work at Provo Canyon for almost a decade before starting his own troubled teen programs. Jared's explanation of the importance of community and the reliance on social connections within the Church of Latter-day Saints gives us some insight into what we would come to find out was Litchfield's preference for working with people he knew and keeping things insular to build a thriving business. His childhood had modeled a world where your community was your network, and you utilized those relationships for almost everything. We see that same core belief in how he built his WASP empire not long after he left Provo Canyon. Given what he learned during his tenure at the school, we were curious to know how his programs would mirror or differ from where he was trained. So Caroline asked his brother, Narvin.
And what was, at the time, do you remember any of the conversation of, you know, he had had such a long experience at Provo Canyon School. Was it the idea that like, well, we can replicate this? Like, I've been running Provo pretty much, right? I mean,
basically, but we could then take some of the things we didn't like Provo was doing and sort of, you know, make a better mousetrap, I guess.
A better mousetrap? That language itself is so telling and yet so vague. Better. Who exactly does better refer to? And who is better benefiting?
To me, at least, this concept of a better mousetrap ended up making so many of our lives worse.
In the following clip, Robert Litchfield sheds light on his approach in a conversation with Dateline NBC for a feature about another WASP program, Paradise Cove, that we will cover in an upcoming episode. But this clip is relevant to more than just Paradise Cove. It seems to show a clear example of his outlook and model that he implemented at his schools.
We hire people with good youth leadership, have some talent working with youth. I think I'm talented working with youth, but I don't have a full college degree in that area. And so I personally don't believe it's necessary.
But when you're dealing with troubled kids and seriously troubled kids, as you describe them, is it not necessary to have someone who knows about that in academic detail?
They change because of the experiences in their lives. And so that's what we're after, an experience, not a counseling type of situation.
And an experience is definitely what many survivors would report having at WASP programs, including myself. Something I've seen across the board in the troubled teen industry is that their treatment model is essentially break you down to build you into what they want you to be. But I think what a lot of us have experienced is that we never got built into anything else. A lot of us just walked away feeling really broken. Broken.
WASP's program model relied heavily on behavior modification, although some of the programs did have therapists for hire if the parents paid extra. In a lawsuit we will dive into later on this season, the lawyer for WASP is quoted at trial saying, "These programs are primarily based on behavior modification. That is, they try to teach the kids responsibility and life skills by showing them that if they do things that are not acceptable in society, there are consequences for those things." Chelsea Filer is a survivor and well-known activist, one who would become a huge proponent in the fight against WASP. You will hear her story throughout this season, but here she is emphasizing a similar point.
A WASP was a network of specialty programs. I would say mostly focused on providing behavior modification for troubled teens. Now, some of these programs were more geared towards wilderness boot camp experience or a little bit more towards the therapeutic realm. At least that's the way that they market themselves. But realistically, what we were experiencing in this program was a very extreme form of behavior modification. Specifically, I think that it was based on aversion therapy. And that's the pretty much the theory that if you can punish a child enough, eventually they'll learn. And that's exactly what WASP was. It was punishment. They used fear and control, peer pressure, making examples out of some kids in order to control the other kids. Okay, let's use a frame of reference, right? A lot of people could compare this to, let's say, a boarding school or a mental health hospital or a correctional facility, juvenile hall. But the problem is that WASP did not provide real school. WASP did not provide real therapy. WASP did not provide the same kinds of rights that we would have had if we were in juvenile hall, let alone basic necessities. And considering the fact that most of us didn't even commit any crimes, it's all the more concerning. And that's what's really put WASP in a league of their own.
One of the most notorious schools in the WASP network was called Casa by the Sea in Mexico. As its name suggests, Casa by the Sea was just a few steps away from the water. But the teens were kept behind high walls just yards from the ocean that created even more distance between them and the outside world. Chelsea Filer arrived in 2001. This is her recollection of her time at Casa.
We were right there on the beach, Casa by the Sea. And yet, I don't think most of us even saw the beach the whole time we were there. We were surrounded by these high walls. There were no windows out to see the water, except for there was this one red gate. And it was the only peek that we could ever take at the ocean. Now we'd have to sneak a peek because we weren't allowed to look out of line. So I'd have to say that's one of my only fond memories of Casa by the Sea is that sometimes you'd be able to look out and see dolphins on the water, cruise ship, or the island far away in the distance, and it really kind of made you long for freedom. Just watching the birds flying above the facility, and you just wish that was you. Wish you could actually go to the beach. You're so close. So close, but so far. On one hand, Casa by the Sea was a large facility. We had, regular food. We had somewhat of a regular schedule. We had school. So I would say that it was, there was more normalcy to it. Now, CASA followed the same WASP model where we had a level system. And this would be where the upper levels would essentially be policing the lower levels. And that was, you know, kids that had been there longer and moved up in the levels based on a point system. And that point system, very much like a game, was that you needed to try to get points so that you could earn your rights back and basic privileges. Privileges like being able to speak to other people, being able to call your parents, even eat condiments at dinner, and a candy bar once in a while. That being said, there was still quite a few things that I consider abusive. We had quite a bit of physical abuse at CASA by the Sea, but not everyone experienced it. We also had somewhat of a systemic psychological abuse that we were all under. And that was significant. That was what made CASA CASA. And realistically, that's what made WASP WASP.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Marina was another survivor of CASA. Growing up in California, she didn't have an easy life. When she was young, she shares that she encountered both sexual abuse and family addiction.
I grew up with a family of drug addicts. I watched my aunt get clean off of heroin. I watched my alcoholic uncle and his tweaker girlfriend ruin two beautiful children. I did find pot at a young age. I didn't use it to escape. It fixed a serious problem that hindered my ability to be comfortable and functioning. So when my mom found out about that, she just assumed it was a drug addict.
Due to the family history, her mom assumed that her pot smoking was part of a larger problem.
And I had found out that my mom had a packet from WASP. So I saw all the schools. I saw everything. And I stole her car keys and stole her car. So I stole her car. Not really the smartest thing to do, but I just felt like if I could get as far away, I would. And I did at 14 with no license and no previous driver's experience. But I did crash her car trying to do a U-turn. And that is the actual incident that got me sent to CASA.
Marina spent a lot of her time at CASA in isolation. And she said being alone was familiar territory. She shares how she managed upon arrival.
I obviously shut a lot of it out, just being real. I knew they weren't going to follow the rules. I knew they weren't going to do what they said in the rule book. I knew it all was just designed to break me down. Mm-hmm. And I had been so alone before that it was just, I was conditioned. Yeah, I had some friends here and there, but like I said, I knew from a very young age, stay alone. Because as soon as someone attaches to you, it leaves you vulnerable. I'd get out and I'd have to sit in group and someone would tell me that everything was my fault. And yet they don't know my story. Like to hear that a lot of the things that I could barely remember were my fault. And then you've lost my love for the day. Well, yeah, Marine, it's really hard to love you. Look at how you act here. You hear that in therapy or in a group session. Well, yeah, Marine, it's really hard to love the type of person you are. You're always in staff watch. You're always violent. You're always staff it. And I was like, yeah, I love that about me. You don't have to, but I do. It was the fight that kept me going, and it was the ability to dissociate. It was the ability to cope in really heinous situations that I didn't care. I was going to make it out of there. I wasn't going to be someone who died because of this place. I wasn't going to be someone who ran away, and I was going to give him hell until I left.
How did these survivors end up at facilities like CASA and allegedly endure so much abuse? We need to start at the beginning, this season, on Trapped in Treatment.
They will tell parents that their kids are going to die. You're going to find your kids in a gutter. If you don't do something now, your child will die.
If someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, not just because I can say, oh, been there, done that, sham, scam, beware, harm, danger, you know?
I'm just telling you up front, we were the first real thing on the internet actually making money.
And they just sit on you until you were done being sat on, until you had no more fight left in you.
And I was not put into the general population. I was instantly put into a dog cage. That was my punishment.
It was some kind of weird combination of like Lord of the Flies and state prison.
One of the things I've learned about human nature is when we see someone suffering, it's painful for us. So we want to avoid it. And after a while, people's eyes just slide past you like you're not even there.
All of our efforts to reach Robert Litchfield for comment were unsuccessful, and he did not respond to our requests for comment. According to our research, Robert Litchfield has never been charged with or found guilty of any crime stemming from allegations of abuse or in connection with WASP or any of the schools affiliated therewith.
Hey everyone, it's Paris. Thanks for listening to episode one. Today's show is just the beginning. This season is shocking. You won't want to miss an episode, so be sure to subscribe on iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're here, support our work and leave us a review or follow us on Instagram at Trapped in Treatment. And for the survivors out there, I see you, survivor.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.